Okay, now tonight's review is an interesting book. Oh, that's so cool. So chess has finally been accepted as a sport. The FBI files on Bobby Fischer and his mother, Regina. Yes, yes, I think that's a great idea. That's what I would do. Slasky's the guy I'm going to have to beat. Hi, welcome to another installment of Chess and Books with Fred Wilson, and I'd like to remind everybody that my guest tonight is woman grandmaster Maria Ivanka. Maria Ivanka has had quite a distinguished career as a player for Hungary. She was, first of all, 9 times woman champion of Hungary. She was pretty much the top Hungarian chess playing woman before the Polgars. Well, she told me that she currently has a FIDE rating of around 2300, but she's stronger than that, because if you go to her website, which is IVANK, Ivanka Maria period or dot tripod.com/, that's Ivanka Maria dot tripod.com/, you'll find a selection of her games, and you'll see that she beat Catherine Dishvili twice. And incidentally, she was also champion of Texas, where she lives with her husband and children in Austin, Texas. She was champion of the state of Texas 3 times. And she has a nice game, a very good game, that she beat international master Joe Bradford, who usually wins the Texas championship. I'm sure he's relieved that she doesn't play much anymore, if at all. She's also written a book about her career called Silver Queen, and the silver reflects on the fact that she led the Hungarian Olympic women's chess team to 4 silver and 2 bronze medals in the women's Olympics. I mean, always coming behind the Russians. But evidently in her personal battles with Apprentice Billy, who was like the first real grandmaster who was a woman, Ivanka came out on top several times. So this is a very interesting guest. He's had a rich and varied career. He's written an interesting book about her career and the last 40 years of world champion and Olympic chess. So hang on. And at about 9:15 to 9:20, we'll start interviewing Maria Ivanka, but start sending questions for woman grandmaster Maria Ivanka now. You can send them via ICC to Tony Rook, and about women's chess, about anything, preparation, coaching, teaching. I noticed from looking at her games that she seems to be a ready English opening specialist on the white side. And curiously, like many players like that, let's say Pulukiewski or people like that, she's also a Sicilian and a Nidor player. So she certainly knows a lot about these systems. So please send us questions for WGM Maria Ivanka. Okay, I'm going to review 2 books tonight briefly. One which I only have the right to review because they sent me a review copy, and I play neither side of the opening, but I'm impressed at the arrangement. It's 288 pages. It's by Lev Sakis, and it's French Defense 3, Knight D2, the Tarasha variation. And as some of you might know, Sakis has been a French player his entire life. He wrote a seminal book on the French, The Complete French, in 1992. But the volume of theory has increased to such an extent that he has had to produce 3 volumes to cover the whole opening nowadays. And the first volume has come out from Batsford, 2295, almost 300 pages on a double column, formatting, etc. This seems to be a relatively fair price. This book is packed with analysis, material, and complete quote a little bit from the preface. Way back in 1982, the question, what am I going to do against the king's pawn, became an utter torment for me. The openings of my youth, Roy Lopez and Sicilian, were affected by some holes that were difficult to plug, and the problem of choosing a new defense was nothing short of life and death matter. It was then that I decided to join that large group of strong men, grandmasters, who cannot imagine life without the French defense. And I have never regretted this decision. In my view, the French defense is like a beautiful, proud lady who doesn't give her heart away easily. You may spend hours on end in the study of long and complicated variations, but that isn't enough to grasp all the secrets of this difficult opening. You have to devote yourself to it, heart and soul. Only then, perhaps, will you penetrate its numerous mysteries. It is quite impossible even to begin learning the French without studying memorable games by great masters of the past, such as Nimzowitsch, Bandinic, and Petrosian. I have also had much pleasure analyzing games by contemporary players, of course, Korshnoi, Ullmann, Vaganyan, Yusupov, Mikhail Girovich, Anshirov, and even Anand, and many, many more. It shouldn't be forgotten that the essential struggle in these games takes place not in the opening itself. Another good reason, this is a fret aside, to perhaps study the French is nobody's going to nail you in 10 or 12 moves. This can't be done. Alright, back to the book. It shouldn't be forgotten that the essential struggle in these games in the opening itself, but in the complex, intricate labyrinth of the middle game. The French is less exposed to the winds of chess fashion than, say, the Nydorf variation. I have nonetheless endeavored to provide up-to-date material, although considering the speed at which theory develops today, the reader must be alert and indeed wary. But by the time this book comes out, assessment of some variations may have turned a full 180 degrees. I've looked through this today, off and on, played over a couple of games, noticed his writing style is quite pleasant, very, very forthright man, Sakis. I'd like to meet him. Maybe I could get him as a guest sometime, because we can clone Israel also. Where he lives now in Israel, and he was a former Soviet champion, lifelong adherent of the French, and as many of the rest of you, many others of you also know, he was lifelong adherent of the Benoni defense against D4. So, okay. I recommend this to two groups of players. Okay, everybody over 1700-1800 who either plays the French or wants to play the Tirache variation 3-knight-d2 against the French. This looks like a heck of an objective book by a man who's devoted his life to playing the French defense against 1-e4 or pawn to king 4. So I actually, without being able to tell you that all the analysis is correct and accurate and up-to-date, because I'm not a Tirache player, and I'm not a French player. I, in fact, shouldn't say this, warning opponents, but I play the exchange variation with C4 against the French because I like open positions. I'm telling you that this looks like a book for $22, $23, 300 pages, that if you're a French player, you have to buy. If you want to play the Tirache variation against the French, you should buy it. Very impressed with a cursory look at this book. Okay, one more review. And it's an interesting book. It's called The Gruenfeld Defense Revealed by Michael Kardakovsky, who was my guest on chess.fm. I think about a month ago, right, Tony?
I think so, yeah.
Yes. Michael Kardakovsky, you might remember, is an intimate friendship with Garry Kasparov, was one of his analytical seconds during his match with Anand, and is a Gruenfeld specialist. And I actually met him at the New Jersey State Championship, very nice man. And I believe Peter Tamburo has reviewed this book already, or is intending to, on his openings for amateurs, because Peter was himself a Gruenfeld specialist and really understands the defense. But I have to tell you, it's the Gruenfeld Defense Revealed is really probably the best thing you could get if you want to just take it up cold. He gives you a history of the defense. He discusses the best and worst examples of what happens when you play the opening. He gives you all the tricks and traps that you can avoid and shows you what they are. He has a nice section on what's hot, meaning basically you know, what are they doing right now? What is hot now against the defense and against these sharp lines, especially in the exchange variation? And then he has some very dense theory towards the end, giving you games that you should really, really know and discover. I was going to read a little bit from his introduction. He says, and I like the formatting. Besides the Linares diagrams, the book is kind of well spaced out. The only dense analysis is in the last 25 pages or so, which he calls details, which are games you really have to know and be familiar with and be familiar with the various options. But otherwise, the formatting is kind of spacious and clear, and you know, he's trying to introduce you to a whole new way of thinking about playing the black pieces against D4. And in his introduction, he says, "The author of an opening book tries to lift a veil on the opening secrets, illustrating his ideas with the best games or game fragments he can find. Every author is hoping that his work will be understood and appreciated by his readers. Moreover, he hopes to see an increase in the popularity of the opening among chess players of all levels. The author of this book is no exception. The book does not set out in the traditional way, describing the opening in strict order, line by line, system by system. Here, each chapter is presented as a separate thematic article. The end result, hopefully, will be that you will have a more conceptual approach to the opening you have decided to play. The book starts literally with first steps, running through the basic moves, the basic motivation of the opening. Goes to strategy, tricks and traps, has a series of tests for yourself, so it's also good for people studying tactics. And he has a couple of interesting quotes about de Gruyneveld. By the way, I actually don't like de Gruyneveld, but when I played D4, I was uncomfortable playing against it. I had a feeling I should get an advantage because I'm kind of a center fanatic. But I ended up avoiding the exchange variation. It was like trying to play some side of the knight off. There was too much theory to have to know. Center was like too fluid, even for me. So I ended up playing bishop g5 systems against the Gruyneveld and beating weaker players with it and drawing with stronger players, even masters, but not getting much. So even though I personally don't like the Gruyneveld, I think honest and objective enough to tell you that it always caused me problems when I played D4. Now it doesn't anymore because I switched to E4, but that's another story. Okay. He quotes Goko on the Gruyneveld defense. If white plays precisely and logically, he should get an advantage. While for black, to get a good game, he must rely on occasional tactical chances. Fortunately for Gruyneveld players, such occasions occur quite often. Very, very interesting. At the end of the very end of the book, he quotes Kasparov, of course, because Kratakovsky was Kasparov, one of Kasparov's second, and is still an intimate of Kasparov. I'll finish with one more piece of specific advice. I'd like to quote Garry Kasparov, who once told me, "This is an opening in which you never know beforehand what kind of threat you may face during the game and where it comes from. Therefore, you have to be ready to meet your opponent's plans at any time and on any part of the board." That applies when playing black or white. Very, very interesting book. I remember my friend Peter Tambura was very impressed with it, and I've been looking through it the last couple of days. It has a number of very important, that we call seminal complete games. Again, the formatting is spacious, but this makes it easier for weaker players or less experienced players to study an opening book. And I would say this is a good book for people 13, 1400 strength up through master. If you're a master, you probably don't need this book. And if you're an improving 1900 player and you want to switch to the Gruyneveld, I think this is a good way to begin. The Gruyneveld Defense Revealed by Michael Kratakovsky. Another Batsford book. It's $21.95. Seems a little bit pricey at 175 pages. But, does seem to be the best introduction to the Gruyneveld defense that I have ever seen. Okay, well, we're going to take a short break, and I'd like to remind everybody to send questions for Maria Ivanka, woman grandmaster, 9 times woman champion of Hungary. and six-time medalist winner in the women's Olympiad, and three times champion of Texas, which shows you how the world is getting smaller. So we're going to take a short break, 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll be back with woman grandmaster Maria Ivanka. Looking for Trouble, Recognizing and Meeting Threats in Chess is the title of Dan Heisman's new book. It helps you to recognize threats by providing over 200 problems in which you focus on identifying and meeting threats ranging from extremely easy to fiendishly difficult. But even the identification of difficult threats, and sometimes more importantly how to meet them, is discussed in a manner which should greatly benefit players of all levels. Now available at chesscafe.com for only $15.95. The best in chess, all the time, www.chesscafe.com.
Why do people join the Internet Chess Club? To make friends. Club members come from over 70 countries and represent all ages, skill levels, and languages. The Internet Chess Club operates one of the largest chat areas on the entire Internet. Special discussion channels allow you to chat about various chess topics and general interest subjects such as sports, politics, and foreign languages. Youth groups and scholastic channels exist for younger members. Keep in touch with chess buddies no matter where in the world they live. The Internet Chess Club. It's the best place to play chess on the net.
Hi, folks. Red Wilson back with woman grandmaster Maria Ivanka, formerly of Hungary, who now lives with her husband and family in Austin, Texas. Maria, thank you for appearing on my show.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and hello, everybody.
Oh, okay. Well, Maria, people like to know about the beginnings of strong chess players. We like to know how old they were, when they learned how to play, and who originally taught them, and did they get any significant teaching, training, or coaching from certain individuals. So talk about that. I imagine that you learned to play some point in the 1950s in Hungary, right?
Actually, I started relatively late, at least comparing today's situation. I was 11 years old when I played on my first tournament. And I started accidentally. I didn't even know that I could play chess, because I never played any game. I just watched my father playing with my brothers. And it happened once that my brothers didn't came home late night from a chess club, which was very near to our home. It was just one block away. So my parents did send me down there to bring the boys home. And I went down there, and of course both of them were playing, so they said, okay, just a second, wait for a little bit until we finish the game. And I was just standing waiting there, and somebody asked me to play a game, and I thought, I have time, so why not? I'm waiting anyway. And I started to play a game, and it turned out that the guy was the coach of that chess club.
Uh-huh.
So when my father came down and he wanted to collect all the kids, then the coach told me that he thinks I'm very talented. And he encouraged us to come down regularly. And this was during a summer vacation. So during the summer vacation, I went down to the club just a couple of times. I can't remember how many times. And when the school year started, then was the championship for schoolgirls. And I immediately won that tournament, even though I was 11, and it was the tournament was for under 14.
Wow. Was this in Budapest?
Yes, it was in Budapest. And, of course, I was so happy with this tournament winning that it gave me enough fire to start. And then Iva Karakas, who was a well-known Hungarian player at the time, and she was internationally recognized, and she won twice the senior championship, world championship.
For women?
for women, yeah.
Okay.
That tournament was in 1991 and 1992 in Germany. Mm-hmm. The senior world championship, they were told at that time. Anyway, she started to coach me after I won that school tournament.
Did you win that school tournament mostly with good tactics?
I can't hear you.
Did you win that first tournament, your school tournament, at 11? Did you win it mostly with good tactics? You couldn't have really known the openings too well yet.
Yeah, I did not know any openings. I was absolutely not trained, as I mentioned. But most of the other girls were not very well prepared. Although there were Grandmaster Barca, who is, I don't know if his name is well known in America, but he
is. Yes, he is. Yeah,
yeah, probably. He was a very good chess player at his time, and his daughters were in the group. And also Ruža Verovici, who was my teammate on all these Olympiads. She was also there, so there were some girls who had a little more experience than I had. So it was very excited to beat them.
It sounds like, though, that you were good at tactics early, that you just had a natural inclination for making combinations and you know, pins, forks, double attacks, skewers, like spotting tricks.
Yes.
And that may have been the reason for your initial success, but after you won this tournament, who became your trainer or your coach?
Yeah, Ivo Korkas was my very first trainer.
Uh-huh.
And then when I started to get better, and actually we started to compete against each other for the Hungarian championships, then Tibor Florian, he was an international master. Unfortunately, he already died, as well as Ivo Korkas. So Tibor Florian was the secretary of the Hungarian Chess Federation for a long time, and he was a very intelligent man, speaking several languages, and a very good trainer. So I can thank to him a lot for my results. And there were other inspiring events in my life. For example, Lajos Sportis was my teammate, my club teammate.
Uh-huh.
And also in the same chess club played Szabó, Dilek, Forintos, probably these names hopefully are...
No, we know who these people are. These are grandmasters.
Yeah. So it was a very strong chess club. Actually, it is the same club where the Bolgár sisters started their career. So it was a very nice place to play there. And, of course, I learned a lot from them.
Since you mentioned Lajos Portis, one of the questions I've already received for you from a fellow on the Internet called the Chess Guru is what is Lajos Portis like as a person, and do you have a favorite story about him?
He took chess very scientifically and very seriously. His whole life was on chess, and therefore he probably, for outsiders, he seemed kind of morose as a human being, but he was not. He's a very nice guy, and he is still playing chess from time to time, but what he really enjoys is singing.
I've heard that. He has a great voice.
Yes, he has a great voice, and he took voice lessons, so he's getting better and better.
And he must be in his mid to late 60s by now.
Yes. He participated on several occasions on the opening of chess tournaments or the closing ceremonies, and he was singing, so... I think he found his direction after finishing his chess career.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know if you get like New in Chess or Chess Today or things like that. Chess Today is an internet news letter that comes out every day, and it's published by Alex Baburin, Maria, from Dublin, but it's terrific for daily news. And Porter's played in the last Hungarian championship and came in tied for third and fourth, I think behind Axe and somebody, so he's still pretty strong.
Yes, he is.
I mean, I was surprised to see his name way up on the table because he's older, right? But still, he did very, very well.
But from time to time, he is playing, so he's still very close to the chess arena.
Okay, so you summed him up as kind of a nice guy who was absolutely dedicated to
yes.
chess for, I
exactly.
guess, 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, well, let's get back to your career. So now you're a talented teenager approaching master strength, and, how did you become a chess master? I mean, was there a single tournament or event that suddenly you crossed the border and became a Hungarian master?
Yes, there were tournaments where, yeah, you had to reach certain points and then you could get the master title. It was the same with the international master title and the same with the grandmaster title. Of course, you have to make the good result at least twice to earn these titles.
Now, most of your chess play was back in the good old days, or maybe not that good. You were totally segregated. I mean, were you ever allowed to play men?
Playing against whom?
Men.
Oh, men. Yes. Actually, there were smaller tournaments where I had the chance to play against men. And also there was, in Budapest, we had a team championship.
Uh-huh.
As I mentioned, my club team. There were several clubs and several teams, and they had a championship, again, playing against each other. And of course, these were men. So there were funny stories when I started to play, and I was like 12 or 13 year old. And I was very short at that time. Later, I grew a little bit, but as a child, I was very short.
Uh-huh.
And I sat down across my opponent, and usually my opponent didn't understand what am I doing on the chair, and he thought probably it's my father who will play, and I'm just waiting there for my father.
Not the little girl.
Yeah, definitely not. And they just asked me to send my father here, and I said, okay, I'm sorry, but I'm the player.
and if you beat them, it was even worse.
Yes, when I beat them, then some of them were angry, some of them were smiling and unbelieved. So it was funny. I enjoyed that a lot.
I can imagine. Well, I mean, I know from my own experience in playing women in tournaments that I just think of them as players. I don't think of them as women because that's a big mistake.
Yeah, today it's easier because you hear about a lot of young players who are very good, but at that time it was quite unusual, especially for a young girl to play chess and play it seriously.
Let's talk a little bit about you. Well, it's interesting to me because I didn't find out in advance. So you become an adult, a young adult. You're a chess master. You're even an international women's international master, and you won the Hungarian women's championship 9 times. Were you a chess professional, like from the period maybe 18 through 30 in your life? I mean, or did you have to do something else to earn a living?
I was a chess professional because during the 60s and 70s in Hungary and in every socialist country, it was usual that we got a regular monthly payment for playing chess, for making good results. Of course, you had to have in the cream of the international players to get that, but I was and our team was, so therefore I would consider myself as a professional, although I always had other things in my life. I was 19 when I became an international master. At that time, the grandmaster title for women did not exist because there were just quite a few international players, so it was no reason have a different title for that. But I got married when I was 22, and my children started to born. So I was busy with my family, and I also finished. Meanwhile, I finished a university.
Uh-huh.
So I was busy with other things, and then I did not study as much as I had to, probably, and as my opponents did. So from that point of view, I was not professional enough to make even higher results, even better results on the international field, although my best world championship result was being on the sixth place, which is not bad.
No, that's quite good. And you also beat, I would say, the leading woman of player of your generation would have been Gaprindashvili.
Yes.
And you beat her at least twice, and the games folks are on her website. And the second game, the Sicilian, is incredibly exciting, interesting night off in which Maria is black against Nonna Gaprindashvili, one of the top maniac attacking playing women of all time, I would say. And,
yeah, and I'm very proud of these two wins. And actually, this one has a story too. Both of these games were born in Yugoslavia, in the European Cup Championship in Vranjačka Banja, which is a spa, a little spa in Yugoslavia. And at the very same tournament, they organized this tournament always in December. So we were there, and in 1969, when very first I was 19, and I beat Gaprindashvili. I was very excited. And in 1971, at the exact same tournament, I had my second victory over her. And then 1972 came, the exact same tournament, and I almost beat her. I was a pawn off, and I had a very good chances for winning. But unfortunately, this game finished as a draw. So it is very interesting that always at the same tournament, somehow she felt uneasy playing
yes.
against me on the same tournament at the same time every year.
Well, it seems to me that in the games that I looked at you played against her, you saw more tactics than she did, and that, and she being a great tactician, that would make her kind of anxious that, oh, this woman sees a lot of sharp stuff, I gotta be careful. So, well, I mean,
on the other hand, she probably wanted to beat me in the second time, and that's why she also wanted to have a very sharp position.
Uh-huh. Well, the game on your website is fascinating. I looked at it today, and there's a lot of stuff going on. You could probably take about 10 positions from the game and create a little tactics course on it. But, did you have to play her in the Olympiads, also?
Against Gaprindashvili?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. We had lots of games against each other. And, of course, she succeeded several times against me, and we had many, many draws. But probably the most interesting game on the Chess Olympiads was when, in the last round, we played against the Soviet Union. It was in 74 in Medellin, Colombia,
uh-huh.
and if we win this game, we played on two boards at that time.
Two boards and one alternate, right?
Yes.
And now it's been increased to three and
yeah,
one.
Yeah, now three plus one.
Okay.
So if we make 1-1 against the Soviet team at that moment in the very last round, then we are tying on the first place.
Uh-huh.
And I had an amazing game against Gaprindashvili on the first board, and the game ended with a draw. Unfortunately, we lost on the second board, so we got our...
You got another silver medal.
Second place.
who was the second board for the Russians in 74? Was it Isolani, or...
For the Russians? At that tournament, it was, let me think, it was Kushnir.
Ah, Alla Kushnir.
Yeah,
Kushnir. I forgot.
Yeah, Kushnir. Later she played for the Israeli team, but at that time she was in the Soviet team, and of course she was the second on the world championship for several times, so she played many matches against Open nationally.
Hearing about the silver medal that was almost gold, to ask you about your book. You've written a book about your life and career, Silver Queen. It's available from Amazon.com, and it's, I assume, soon, if not now, it'll be available from my sponsor, Chessbuffet.com. But could you talk a bit about the book and what's in it? And I noticed that you used an interesting little catchphrase that, besides about your life and career and about the world championship and the Olympic chess history in the last 40 years, there would be some discussion of gossip, scandals, and intrigues. So perhaps you could share with us at least one of them so people get an idea about what else they might find in your book.
Yeah, this book is about the 40 years, which covers my whole chess career. But, of course, I did not write only about myself, but I wrote about every important chess event during that 40 years. So there are games from all the world championship matches and from Olympiads, from men and women, both. So I hope it is interesting for everybody else, but definitely it is it was very important for me to write it for my family, and for myself to see clearer what happened in my life, because it is now much more in order in that book. So it is not just a memory, but it is now. So I'm very happy that I could make it as a book. At first, it didn't start it as a book. It was just I had a great, very large correspondence during my chess tournaments. I always wrote long letters to my parents and to my husband, to my family. And first, I just collected these letters and just wrote them all together, and it was almost a book.
So, in other words, you have a lot of behind-the-scenes information about what went on at various Olympiads and tournaments.
Yeah, there was several interesting things. For example, there was it happened one more time that we almost won the Olympiad. It was on 1918 Malta. We also missed it just only half a point.
Uh-huh.
And in 1978 in Buenos Aires, where our men's team succeeded with the gold medal.
Right, and I'd like to hear that story. I mean, a lot of people don't know it, but
yeah, it was a fantastic event because Soviet Union had the Olympic gold back as long as they had Olympiads, I think. So it was an extremely great thing to finally to beat them. And it was a very close situation, and we heard that gossip that since Hungarian men played against the Yugoslavs in the last round, that maybe the Yugoslavs helped to the Hungarians, because of course the Russians were not very popular politically, not the chess players, but the political situation, because of the political situation. So, but actually, Yugoslavs could not help, because everybody was playing for themselves. Let me show it with another example. In 1972, in the Skopje Olympiads, where we finished on the second place, it was the same situation that in the last round, we played against the Soviets, I'm wrong. We played against Yugoslavians. It was a very complicated situation. So,
Do you think, though, that the Russians put pressure on people to not perform as well as possible in certain situations in the Olympiad? I mean, you know, there's stories that Portish got a phone call during the USSR World match, the first one, and he came back and gave someone, Korsner or somebody, a draw in a much better position. I mean, we hear these stories about intimidation. Have you heard them also?
We always hear these stories, but I never really realized that it is true. As I mentioned in Skopje, in the last round, the Soviet ladies were several points ahead of us, so it didn't really matter for them that whether they win or lose the last round game against us.
Uh-huh.
But the Hungarian men team played against West Germany, and the Soviets played against Romania. So if the Soviets men beat Romania, then they win the gold medal.
Right.
So it was told that if the Romanians maybe will lose against the Russians, if the Russian ladies will fight against us for the Romanian ladies. so it is unbelievable, but I don't think anybody really listens to these rumors, because the Romanian ladies and the Romanian men and the Russians and the Hungarians, they all wanted to be first or second or third, whatever they could be. So it was such a big fight at the very last moment, always, that I don't think that anybody lost a game on purpose. I cannot imagine.
I can tell you that I believe it was Livojevic in 78 in Buenos Aires lost the game in a Sicilian against one of the Hungarian men that had been played already in the Olympia. So it's a little suspicious. But, I mean, you more than I would understand that there was a great dislike of the Soviet state, not necessarily Russian players, but...
Yeah, definitely not.
But because...
Actually, the players were usually very nice people.
Right, and that was a huge upset when Hungary won the 1978 Olympiad ahead of a strong Russian team. I don't think Karpov was on that team, though, because he had just beaten Korsnoy in Baguio City, I think, and he was a little tired. I think Korsnoy actually went to the Olympiad and played for Switzerland.
I think so, yeah.
The Yugoslavia lost, I will just put it this way, Maria, a suspiciously easy getting crushed by the Hungarians in the last round.
It wasn't easy.
Wasn't easy. Okay, well, I've got to look at the games again. Now with databases, we can really look at the games easily.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the Yugoslav chess was very strong at that time, and they organized lots of tournaments. Chess was very popular in Yugoslavia, so I cannot imagine that they would not fight for the better place they could get. And, you know, in chess Olympiads, you just have a half a point less than you need, and then you lose like 10 spaces. We are going back because there are just so many teams.
I understand that the difference with the one or a half a point or 1.5 points can drop you down to 20th from a bronze medal. And,
exactly.
And the medals, especially, I guess, in the socialist countries, these Olympic medals were very, very important.
It was
meant more than in the United States or France or somewhere like that. It was just because it was kind of state-subsidized chess. Many of you were professionals.
Actually, we had our living on the good results, as I mentioned, that we were getting our monthly payments for playing chess, but if we could not succeed, then of course we did not earn anything. So it was very important to have good results.
Okay. Well, let's move your career along, because you and your family ended up in an interesting place. And the last championship you won, people would have a hard time guessing if I had told them at the beginning of the show. I think it was the championship of Texas.
Yes.
So perhaps you could describe how you came to move to the United States, live in Austin, Texas, and become three-time champion of Texas, not lady champion, champion of Texas.
My husband, Andrzej Budinski, is a chess master from Hungary, and he's a computer science specialist. So that was the reason why we came to Texas, because he came to the University of Texas at Austin to study some more computer science.
When was this?
That was in 1979.
Uh-huh.
Actually, we were here earlier in 1975-76. Then he was here just for a shorter fellowship trip. But when he started his studies, it was 79, and then we spent here longer terms, like 3 years at first, and then we went back to Hungary and then again came. So our life is still going back and forth between Hungary and the United States. But when I arrived to visit my husband, then of course the first thing was to look around what kind of chess tournaments are here. So we together went to Las Vegas for the U.S. Championship. And there, we tied on the fifth place. The four winners were, I remember, Banker, Brown, and two others I can't recall at the moment. The interesting thing was that I played against Brown on that tournament, and after the game, Walter told me that he was, as usually, he in his thinking, he was calculating his moves, and he couldn't guess my following move. So he considered all the possibilities, and then he always was surprised to see a different move from me. And his first impression was that it must be a mistake. Instead, it turned out to be a good move. So he was surprised by the difference of male and female thinking process. So he was simply thinking differently.
Uh-huh. And was this the first tournament you played against male grandmasters? Or beat any?
Yes, I have a very memorable day.
Uh-huh.
Which on which I had the chance to beat two grandmasters on the same day. It was another, I think it was another national championship, where I played in the morning, I played against Grünfeld, and in the afternoon I played against Shomkovich, and I succeeded both games. So it was a really, a really special day for me.
Did it finally dawned on you that perhaps if your life had gone differently, that you could have competed against the men grandmasters had you been encouraged to do so, that it was indeed possible? And I think you made another interesting statement. You said you felt, instead of you being intimidated, you felt that they were a little more intimidated playing a woman, at least back 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I think. After several tournaments, people got used to it, playing against myself. But for example, if you see Walter Brown's results against women, he has a very bad result. Not on, I wouldn't say against me, because we played several games and he had beaten me several times, more than I had beaten him. So, he played against Crumling, Pia Crumling, and I think against Rapindashvili and some other ladies. And he had a poor result altogether against lady players. So it is not easy. It probably men feel, as he mentioned me, that they feel the difference, that they feel that the women players are somehow unpredictable. Whatever they usually expect from a man player, somehow women are thinking differently and make different ideas, different moves.
Well, it's interesting. I looked at several of your games. I noticed that apparently you became a kind of ready English specialist, C4, G3 kind of player with white. And I'm wondering if that's so you could avoid having to study tremendous amounts of opening theory.
My weakness was always the preparation for openings. So usually my opponents had more precise preparations, and I was deliberately trying to play variations which have less lines or less important lines, which you have to play very carefully or very exactly. So that's why that's how I started to play these English kind of variations. But that also meant that I played many openings, so probably more than others, because I did not have a very strict opening repertoire. Therefore, I could play, for example, I played the Sicilian with white and with black.
Right.
Which is an advantage. You learn the variations, and then you can use it with both colors.
Exactly. And I think it's like one reason. When you were playing, but less so now. I think less people are willing to give an English opening player a Sicilian with an extra move, because it's just that extra move means a lot. And, I mean, people like Korsnoy have demonstrated it again and again and again. So,
exactly. That's the other reason why I played, why I liked English opening.
But I have a sense that you are always kind of looking for tactical opportunities. Just looking at several games today that are on your website, but
yes.
Always alert for tactics, Maria. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
And you didn't mind endgames either. You seem to be a good endgame player.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads me to a question. Did you at least rigorously study endgames under your two coaches when you were young?
Yes. I'm not sure that today youngsters really start studying chess with the endgames, but I think it's very important to start with the endgames, even though today the opening analysis is seems to be the most important studying stuff. But if you don't know what kind of what kind of situations are winning, if you don't have these pictures in your mind, what are you playing for? It is much more difficult because you are not sure that from the middle game how can you go to a winning end game if you are not absolutely perfect in end games. So I was very happy that my first teachers took very important so very, very important to teach me the end games.
Well, it certainly paid off. Won,
yes,
a lot of medals, a lot of trophies. At the 9 Hungarian championships, who was your main rival? I guess this would be in the 60s and 70s.
At the end of the 60s, it was Eva Karakas, and later it was Zsuzsa Verőci.
Zsuzsa Verőci?
Yes.
Ah, does she still play today? The name now rings a bell.
She is not playing anymore, but she is an arbiter, international arbiter, so you might find her name in tournaments as an arbiter.
And were you and her basically the Hungarian women's Olympic team before the pole guard?
Yes, yes. In our last silver medal, which was in 86 in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, it was already Ildikó Mádl, our teammate, who was also the teammate of the Polgár sisters for the gold medals. They won this team, the Polgár sisters and Ildikó Mádl they had two gold medals for the Hungarian women team in 1988 and 1990.
Finally, you beat the Russians, but you helped pave the way for this to happen. I think. Did you ever play any of the Pogars in a tournament?
No. I played one tournament here in the United States, a big open tournament where Susan Pogar was also playing, but we were not paired against each other, and we tied, so we had the same results.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, Susan has unretired and is training to play on the American Women's Olympic Chess Team.
Yeah, that's what
I thought. She's going to start playing again, which I think is actually a great idea. I don't think she should have ever retired. She was too strong to retire.
Like. Yeah, definitely. And she's very young, so she needs to play because she's a very talented lady, and I hope that she will play for the World Championship title again.
Oh, that would be excellent. And I hope that Judith will play for the other World Championship title. But I suspect that doesn't surprise you that finally a woman came along who's in the top 10 players in the world. That does not really surprise you, does it?
Actually, it is surprising that since she's the only one in that region. So there are no followers, even not even her sisters, and not. Anyone from the Chinese ladies who would have that high ELO rating.
I hear what you're saying. There's no other woman yet in the top 20 players in the world, but there's the Indian girl, Humpy Kanara, is only 15. And her FIDE rating is over 2550, so God knows how strong she can get.
Yeah, definitely. It is always open that what the next generation brings. But until that moment, Judith is the only one who could reach that high.
Maria, one last question before we take 2 or 3 minutes for some commercial breaks. And, you know, you can have a sip of coffee or tea, and so can I, and then we'll come back for you to answer questions from listeners via the ICC to Tony Rook. But my last question is, what were your favorite or most influential books that you learned from as an adolescent, as somebody going from what we would say expert to master strength?
Actually, I hope you know these books because some of them were written by Russians, of course.
I probably do, but it's fine. Tell us what the books were that influenced you.
The main endgame book in Hungary at that time was the Auerbach endgame.
The Auerbach series, yeah.
Yes.
And there are English translations of those now.
I see. And there was an opening book by Panov and also by Pachman.
Ah, so you did read Pachman in Hungarian editions.
Yes.
Okay.
They were all Hungarian books. I mean, they were all translated to Hungarian.
Right, and did you read, like, Budvinik in Hungarian editions?
Which one?
Anything by Budvinik.
Budvinik, yeah, sure. And also Keres.
Ah, Keres, yes. Keres is my favorite chess author.
Yeah.
So you read his 100 Games, then?
Yes.
Oh, that's a great book.
Yeah, we had, actually we had a very good library in the Hungarian Chess Federation.
Uh-huh.
And we could find all these famous books and we could learn from them. And also, Grandmaster Szabó had a fantastic chess library.
Uh-huh.
Since he recently died, I just heard that that his library might come over to the United States somewhere. So I'm not sure what happened to it.
You just helped me with what my again last question. Did you know or have any dealings with Szabó, who was absolutely a great player?
Oh yeah, definitely. He also was my clubmate, teammate.
Uh-huh.
And he was coaching me for a very short time, but it is very memorable. And when I went back to Hungary a couple of years ago, he was already very sick, and I just visited him, and we had an interesting and memorable conversation. So I cherish his memory.
Yeah, he was, my recollection of him is he was a very great attacking player, that even he beat many Russians too.
Yes.
And they were afraid of him a little bit.
Yes.
He was like sort of ferocious with white and black, both colors.
It is interesting that Hungary is a very small country and we had so many famous players.
Well, no, it's, but you had a tradition that begins earlier with,
Marocsi
and, Karusek.
Yes.
Karusek was probably one of the top 10 players in the world when he died of tuberculosis at age 30.
Yes.
And he had beaten Lasker and people like that. And so and Maroxy, I guess you never met him, or did you meet him?
No, I didn't.
But, he was one of the top players in the world for about 10 years, and then he still continued to play up until the 1940s, I think.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In fact, it's interesting. He trained Vera Menchik.
Yes, that's very interesting. And you probably know that Vera Menchik beat Max Oeber
right.
When he was the active world champion.
Yes.
And
wait a minute, Vera Menchik, she was Hungarian, right?
Actually, she was Czech originally, but one of her grandparents was Hungarian.
So
she have some kind of Hungarian roots.
So there's a rich tradition for both men's and women's chess in Hungary.
Yes.
Okay, Maria, we're going to take a short break. Don't you go away. We're going to be off the air for about 2 or 3 minutes. Don't the listeners go away. Start emailing more questions from Grandmaster Maria Ivanka, and we will be back in 2 or 3 minutes. Chess Cafe is proud to announce that the Mark Dvoretsky brand new original book on the endgame will be available next week. Dvoretsky's endgame manual will be a monumental 384-page work that will be a must for every serious player and student. Why, it might even surpass the Averback series. The best in chess, all the time, www.chesscafe.com.
Why do people join the Internet Chess Club? To make friends. Club members come from over 70 countries and represent all ages, skill levels, and languages. The Internet Chess Club operates one of the largest chat areas on the entire Internet. Special discussion channels allow you to chat about various chess topics and general interest subjects such as sports, politics, and foreign languages. Youth groups and scholastic channels exist for younger members. Keep in touch with chess buddies no matter where in the world they live. The Internet Chess Club. It's the best place to play chess on the net. The Internet Chess Club operates the longest-running, largest, and best chess playing service on the Internet. Moreover, the Internet Chess Club is rapidly becoming the largest organization of active chess players in the world. Nowhere else can you find as many chess enthusiasts ready for a quick round of blitz, a short chat, or an impromptu tournament. It is not uncommon to find over 2,000 chess players hanging out on the Internet Chess Club. Developed by leading computer scientists, the service is built on the most robust and feature-rich community game server available. The Internet Chess Club. It's the best place to play chess on the Internet.
Hi, folks. Fred Wilson back with woman grandmaster Maria Ivanka. And before I start reading questions for Maria via ICC or Internet that I've gotten, and then Tony has a bunch more, Maria, you had an interesting story to tell us about the Tbilisi Interzonal that I guess you played in.
Yeah, actually, in 1976, I played in the Tbilisi Interzonal Tournament, and that was the time when Chiburdunidze started her career, and after that tournament, she became world champion. And we had a very interesting adjourn game against each other. She was a pawn up, and Andras, my husband, was my second. And he analyzed that end game during the whole night, and in the morning he found the fantastic solution how we can draw that position, we have to change exchange the rooks. And it is quite unusual in a pawn-down rook endgame that you want to exchange the rooks.
Yes, of course.
But this was a very special situation, and we could do that. And, of course, the Georgian and Russian analyzers did not think about it. So they were analyzing different lines. So when Shiburdan saw this move of mine, she was just puzzled, and she was thinking for at least half an hour or maybe more, but then she had to realize that the position is drawn, even though the whole bunch of analyzers told her that she had a winning position. And I think it was a very fantastic thing that only two of us were there in the Georgian capital, where all these very famous grandmasters were helping and analyzing for Chiburdanidze, and Ondash found this fantastic move. And also at the same tournament, I just wanted to mention how the atmosphere was on a chess tournament in Georgia. Because chess was, and probably still is, extremely popular. So the tournament was played in a huge theater, about 1,000 spectators, maybe more. And of course there are so many people, there is some kind of noise or buzz in the room. So the arbiters had these huge tables which had the signs which said "quiet please," and then they were showing up to the audience, but it didn't help too much. So when we finished our games, it was huge claps and huge noise again. So it was really an unusual atmosphere, like on a football game.
Were they applauding you for holding the adjourned position? Did they understand, a sophisticated audience, that you had sort of performed a miracle to save what everyone thought was a lost adjournment?
It took a big excitement even in the audience. And also at the same tournament was another story, that at the end, when we received our prizes, since it was an official World Championship tournament, the prices were in dollar.
Ooh, dollars were very good back then.
Yes, but it was quite unusual that anyone else than the Russian players will win any monetary prize. So when I was a prize winner, I declared that I wanted to get my price in dollar instead of ruble, which is the Russian money.
Right, and which was not worth too much outside of Russia, or worth nothing outside of Russia.
Yeah, but the funny thing is that they kept the ruble stronger than the dollar artificially.
Yes.
So when they calculated from the Russian money to dollars, it came out that they had to pay me more dollars than it was originally in
oh, because they had
ruble.
They had to keep the lie afloat.
Yes.
That the ruble was worth something.
Exactly. So it was a big scandal of that, and they said that they cannot pay me the prize money in Tbilisi, but when we go back to Moscow, then they will have the amount ready. And when we arrived to Moscow, it was the men's championship, the Russian championship, which was a big tournament in a huge theater and lots of audience. We went there, and the Hungarian leader, Janos Kádár, was there, who was a very big chess fan.
Uh-huh.
And when the Russians saw us talking to Kádár, then they were running with the envelope and bringing the money, because they were afraid that we will tell Janos Kádár that they are not paying the prize money Otherwise, if he wouldn't be there, we might not get him. I'm not sure, but there was a possibility that they will not pay the amount in dollars. At that time, dollar was very, very rare in the countries. So
you were very happy going back to Budapest with some dollars.
Yes, definitely.
I don't think Americans understand how like one of the few secure things in the world up until recently was the American dollar.
Yes.
And now, you know, it's falling behind the euro because they're mad at us or something, but between you and me, Maria, I'd rather have dollars right now. Maybe we should be buying dollars. Well, yes. That's what we have is dollars.
It is not a big difference today, but at that time, especially because of that artificial playing with the numbers,
right.
The dollar was much, much, much more valuable than it really was. So.
Yeah, well, especially in Russia and or Eastern Europe.
Eastern Europe, yeah, that's what I meant, because the Eastern European currency was artificially manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely. It was inflated. I think the values were inflated. Okay, Tony, let's have some questions for Woman Grandmaster Maria Ivanka that you've received via the ICC.
Okay, Fred, we have a couple very good questions. Our first question comes in from guest 311, and the question is, Maria, what do you think about Judit Polgár's recent games, and do you think she could challenge for the world championship someday?
I'm very excited about that recent tournament she's playing, and she's playing very well. And I think that she had better chances for the world championship title in the KO system. So if it is true that they will stop KO world championship, then her chances are lowered by that.
You mean the knockout system?
Yes.
Where you think in a monster tournament, if they hold a great big one, that Ponomarev won his title, and you think she has a tremendous chance in that. But I hear you saying that probably she doesn't really have a good chance to beat Kasparov or Kramnik in a 24-game match.
I think, yeah, that in a longer match, like a 24-game match, actually, the physical difference between men and women, just like in any other sport, will come out much more than it would be in a shorter tournament or in a quicker time, just like in the knockout tournaments had.
So you think that in a long, long grind over 2 or 3 months, the woman players would have less stamina than the average young male American, not male grandmaster. Right?
Yeah, just remember the match between Karpov and Kasparov, which was stopped and then they continued later just because both of them were so exhausted of the games that they just couldn't physically continue.
Well, one of them was exhausted. I mean, Kasparov's story is that he wanted to keep playing. To this day, that's what he said.
I think he wanted to play because he felt that he has better chances than Karpov, but he must have been exhausted too.
No, I agree. I think they both were. I think,
yeah.
However, it didn't work out the way the Karpov people wanted it to.
Yeah, but still Kasparov became the world champion. So.
No, that's exactly what happened. And
yeah.
Karpov made a funny comment about, and someone was asking about, what are Kasparov's chances against you? And he said, they're actually quite good because he's gotten 48 lessons from me. That's how many games I think they played before the match was stopped or something. So.
Yeah.
It was kind of a grimly realistic assessment, I think. Anyway, Tony, do we have more questions for Maria Ivanka?
Fred, we do. We have a question from Cactus on chessclub.com. Maria, aside from physical differences, Are there any differences between men and women chess players?
This is almost about the same question that we are talking about. Definitely for a chess game you need good physical condition. So just like in any other sport, if you physically are not strong enough or not in a very good shape, then you have less chances, because if two good players are playing against each other, the difference is so little, so tiny, that that even just one moment of deconcentration can cause to losing a game. So if you are not 100% concentrating because you are physically not able, because you just have to rest your mind just for a second, then you might lose your game. And I think that on that area, the physical difference between men and women really counts.
Okay, I have a kind of related, maybe not a related question, but one question that was emailed to me, Maria, is, looking back on your career, do you think women had as many opportunities back then as they do now to progress in chess?
One aspect, that they had better situation back then, because there were lots of women tournaments, round-robin tournaments and international tournaments at that time, which they don't have today. On the other hand, today the girls can compete against boys and men, so therefore they have stronger field to compete, and they have better chances to grow their abilities. So yes and no.
No, I understand you. In the United States, and I believe it's the same in England, France, many other countries, in the national scholastic championships, there is no segregation. There is no, like, there is a U.S. junior championship, Maria, but there is no U.S. junior women's championship.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, yes, there is a woman champion of the United States, Anna Hahn, before Jennifer Shahade, but now they actually win it by competing in this massive Swiss tournament with, I think it's about 14 women and the rest men. And as we know, I think Jennifer Shahade won the women's championship in the United States without playing a single woman in that tournament. I think you remember that, Maria. It was 2 years ago. So I think, I mean, they're maybe it's a good thing that the women are basically forced to play many, many good players, and if they're able to get stronger, they will have to get stronger. But
yeah,
you're saying it's a little discouraging that there's no all-play, all-women tournament so much anymore, which would encourage, like, more women to try, you think?
Actually, it is true that women are challenged more by playing against men players, but the problem is that I don't think it's really... As you mentioned, that it is really good to win a woman prize without playing against a woman, because your opponents might not be the same, so in a Swiss system, it never really gives the 100% right result. So I think I'm a better player if I beat my opponent, but if I cannot play against my opponent, then how can I be first on a woman list and someone else is in the second, and we both played against different opponents?
It's an interesting point. I think when Jennifer won it, she clearly played the toughest rating-wise group of players, even though she played no women. When Anna Hahn won it, there was a big tie. And she had the easiest group of opponents in the Swiss versus Jennifer and trying to think of the American Russian girl who Tony, help me here. Who tied with Anna and
Irina Krush.
Irina Krush. Okay, so they had a tougher opponents, but they all ended up with the same score. But at least Anna Hahn did beat them. in the playoff afterwards. In other words, she did get to beat her opponents.
I think
the only...
Yeah, that sounds different.
My only criticism was that it was kind of blitz game. I think it was game at 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been a little more honest to at least make it game at 60 or game at 90. So something approaching real tournament games decided the contest between these three women who tied the match. That's my own feeling.
I'm sensitive to that question because this is my biggest problem with the Polgar sisters, that when they took the Olympic places instead of our old Olympic team, then we did not have the chance to play against each other. So they just simply had higher ELO points, which they collected on men tournaments, and that's why they were selected for the Hungarian Olympic team. And the previous team, which was a silver team, did not have a chance to play against them. So I think it is important that the players are playing against each other, even if it is just like a tie, as you mentioned, and then they did just play for deciding the tie, but at least they did play against each other. So they could clearly show their strengths against each other. We did not have that chance, so I never played against any of the Polgar sisters.
But you would have preferred a qualifying tournament for the Olympics.
Definitely.
Team. And you weren't alone. I guess your friend Verocci felt the same way. And I guess the three Polgars plus Madel were just rated higher than you and Verocci at the time. Was that just the story, right?
At that moment, I think two of the girls had higher, or maybe all of them had, but just slightly higher ratings. So it was really the time when we were about the same level of playing. So I think that we really needed to play that match. The only good thing about that finally they won the Olympic gold medal, and of course we couldn't make any better than that.
Right.
So for Hungary it was not a difference who really won, but it was a difference for us, for Verity and myself, because this was our last chance maybe to win a gold medal finally, because we were so close so many times, and we just needed just one more good player. And actually, if Zsuzsa Polgár could join our team, or if we could play a match with each other and just figure out who is playing on that Olympic team, then we could be an Olympic gold medalist too.
Well, that's an interesting story, that you felt you were sort of denied your last chance. You're still happy with the result, though, because finally...
Oh, definitely.
Finally, somebody broke the Russian hegemony, and it was a long time coming. I bet there was a lot of celebrating, though. In fact, what was the Russian...
Actually, I was there in Budapest when the girls came home from that Olympiad, so... I remember all the celebration and flowers and cheers. At the airport when they arrived.
Well, and they beat a strong team. I think it was Jaberta Nitsi, and I forget who the others were, but I think Jaberta Nitsi was on first board, right, for the Russians. Maybe I saw Lani. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. And was that the one where the Russian defected? Remember?
Yes. Yeah, when
Akhmilovskaya
was there, yeah.
Akhmilovskaya defected and ran off and married John Donaldson.
Yeah, exactly.
But did they replace her with a new person, or did they just play with three players?
No, it was about three rounds before the end, so the other three girls just played the last three rounds. So basically they did not have a reserve for
that must have been a few rounds. An exciting story at the time.
Yes, it was.
Very, very exciting story. Well, Tony, do we have a few more questions for Maria Ivanka?
We do. We have another question from Cactus on chessclub.com. Maria, will there ever be a women's world champion?
You mean as a man champion?
Yes.
A female man champion?
Yes.
As the world champion. Whatever, yeah.
Oh, the world champion.
Yeah.
At first, I wished to see the male world championship to get just one, united one. And then let's see if we can unite the women and men champions to play against each other. Definitely, it would be a very interesting match. In the long run, I'm just thinking about the today's players. In the long run, maybe it is possible. I'm not sure. It depends, as I mentioned before. It depends on the rules. If it is a 24 game match, then the chances are not good for that. But if it is a different situation, let's say like a 12-game match or some kind of different rules, then then there is a very good chance that Lady could beat all the male opponents.
Okay, well, that's an interesting viewpoint. Do you see, Maria, I, as a chess historian, sense that something changed around with your generation, and maybe began with Gaprindishvili, is that women became more aggressive players and were even trained to play more aggressive systems. And I have a woman that works for me, Romanian, who's now American, named Anca Andreana, who's a woman's international master. And when she was trained in Hungary, which would be about 15, 18 years, not Hungary, Romania, they were given the Fischer repertoire. They were told to play King's Indian, Knight off, Roy Lopez. They were told to play very aggressive attacking chess. But do you think this change began kind of with your generation and Gaprindishvili's generation, that the women stopped playing so passively and stopped playing like Tory attacks, Kali systems, and wimpy stuff, and started just really playing very aggressive?
I think it probably came sometimes with my generation, but the reason is for that, I think, it's not that the ladies were told to play more aggressively, but it is just that the women chess did not have any traditions, any backgrounds. So when the first lady started to play, it was somehow it was considered to be a different chess than the male chess. And recently, especially with all these combined tournaments and all the possibilities to play for women to play against men, it is getting more and more united. So the difference is disappearing between the men and women, let's say the aggressivity.
No, I think we're saying people follow their natural tendencies now. I mean, you seem to have been a tactical player who played sort of positional openings, but was very tactical, from what I can see from the games on your website. Gaprindishvili was a total attacking player. Gebertinidze was more, I think you would agree, a Karpov-like player, kind of a grinder, a strangler. Now we have the Chinese girls, Zizheng, Zhu Chen, seem to me to be extremely aggressive players, and that's their tendency. But the Indian girl I mentioned, Humpy Canero, seems to be a positional player. I think now you're just seeing individuals follow whatever their natural inclinations are.
Yeah, but it is not true only for the ladies, but it's true for the men. Like,
oh, of course.
Petrosyan was a world champion, and he was really not a very tactical, not an aggressive player, but he was extremely good at the style what he was playing.
Well, no, I agree. He was true to his style. Karpov is true to his style. I think, you know, Kasparov revels in tactics and out-calculating people. So does Anand. This is what we find today. But the women once had a reputation as being passive players and playing very safe, you know, controlling, safe, solid things, trying not to lose the game. And I think maybe the psychology of women has changed since World War II in general.
Maybe.
But it's not true anymore.
Chess.
Huh?
Maybe it is not true only for chess, but it is true just for...
Exactly. Exactly, that you're allowed to compete in this world and to be aggressive. Tony, more questions for Maria Ivanka.
Yes, Fred. We have a really good question from Vander Lassa on chessclub.com. The question is, Maria, has it been difficult to come from a country where players are well known and chess is a part of daily life to one where chess is hardly ever seen in the mainstream media?
Yeah, that is an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because in Hungary, of course, the chess results were in the daily newspapers, and every night in the radio sport program also told the international tournament results. And when first I came to the United States, of course, chess was absolutely not popular at all. Although when I arrived, it was some kind of stir up because the women chess was absolutely unknown here. And as I started to compete against men, then it was some kind of an interesting thing. So some newspapers and interviews were made at that time because it was some kind of an interesting thing to play against men.
Was it? Did you get some press becoming Texas champion? It's such a macho state.
Yes. In the Texas papers, yes. I still have a few articles which I saved.
The old duel with Big Joe Bradford at Dodge City, and you actually.
Yeah.
You beat him in an endgame.
Two points ahead. To beat him.
What?
It was a big occasion to beat him.
Right.
I was very excited.
And I looked at the game. It's against c4 g3, but you transpose it to sort of a Maroxy blind type position, and he forces the queens off, and then you just completely outplayed him.
Yeah.
Like he thought the endgame, and the endgame was not maybe such a good idea.
But
I have the feeling, though, the position you got against Bradford, you had positions like that many times in your career. You really knew how to play that, didn't you? Those positions.
Yeah, they say that there are positions which you feel, and I think that was the kind of position which I really felt.
No, it looked like you were in total control. I went over it today with one of my talented students who's 8 years old, and I kept pointing out how, like, white just controls more space, more space, more space. And eventually, even this endgame, maybe black can hold, but he's going to allow a strange shot here because he has a potentially undefended piece on d7. And the boy found c5, and he's 8, so there's hope for that kid, right, Maria?
Yes.
I urge people to look at Maria's games on her website, which... Maria, could you give your website address again? Because I
it is ivankamaria.tripod.com.
Okay, ivankamaria.tripod.com /. Interesting website, very easy to find things on it. I will just tell you that the pop-up ads are slightly annoying, Maria, but that's not your fault. That's from Tripod. But they do stop eventually. And Tony, do we have a few more questions for Maria Ivanka?
Yes, we do. We have a really good question that just came in from guest 311. Maria, do you think chess has become a less intellectual game given the ease of access to powerful computer programs that can do much of the analysis for you?
I think chess became a less intellectual game because it became more like a business. I'm talking about the very strong tournaments where the prize money is very, very, very high. So it is very difficult to play an artistic game if you know that huge amount of money is depend on your moves. So maybe you are playing more for the win than for making a nice or good game. And that is what bothers me with the changing.
It's interesting. You're saying that the money has put so much pressure on people to either to play it safe or to win at all costs, which nowadays means opening preparation. I think you would agree that.
Actually, if you check the games of World Championship matches where the pressure is really high, then you realize that these games are not good at all. So mostly not very good games, even though those games are played by the very best players of the world. So pressure doesn't help for the nice games.
Right, and do you also feel that the elimination of adjournments has, which I and Kovalik and others feel, the elimination of adjournments, purportedly because of fear of computer analysis, led to a decrease in the quality of fine, long endgames?
I'm not sure about that.
Well, did you play most of your games where adjournments were legal and necessary, right?
Yes.
And what if you had to play them to a finish? What if you had to play a 7-hour game and that's it, no adjournment? Would you have played less end games you were proud of, especially the one you told me where your husband found this fantastic drink?
The problem again that you have to finish the game probably in a few seconds, so you don't have the time to find the best game, the best moves. So it is again against the good game, the best game which you are always. Have in mind that you want to play a game and making in every situation you want to make the best move. If you don't have the time to think or to prepare, then you cannot make the best moves. Against Walter Brown, I had one game where I had very good winning chances, but that tournament was played by the rule that we had to finish the game in the last period of the game in I don't know, in 10 minutes, 5 minutes, I can't remember. So basically we had to play a blitz game at the end of the game, and I lost that instead of winning. So I really think that the edge-on game is better, even if it means that it's not only your knowledge, but your seconds or seconds help will decide the game.
Well, I sort of agree with you. I mean, we know Bud Minnick had Geller as a second, and Bud Minnick would always credit winning ideas to Geller. And you credited your husband with a drawing idea. By the way, is that game with Gilbert and Itzi, is it in your book?
Yes, it is.
Oh, because now I'm very interested to see the fantastic idea. Because as you point out, generally exchanging rooks when you're a pawn down is into king and pawn ending is 99 times out of 100 a good way to lose more quickly. People like to keep their rooks on for swindling chances.
Yeah, that's why they did not even analyze this line.
Uh-huh. Does your husband... Did he play in the United States at all, or does he still play?
Yeah, actually, he did play on several tournaments a long time ago when he had more time to play. And we are co-champions of Montana, for example.
That's wonderful. You're taking over the West. maybe you guys should move up to Washington State and take on...
Actually, when our kids were younger, I have three sons, I don't know if I mentioned that before, and when they were younger, then we traveled around the United States and played on different tournaments.
Do your sons play?
Pardon me?
Do your sons play chess?
No, they don't play on tournaments. They all know how to play it, but they just play for fun and they don't play on tournaments.
Ah, so you never, got them into scholastic chess, or they...
No.
Maybe you and your husband, we're just too strong.
Or maybe two chess players are just enough in one family.
That might be a point there. At least you and your husband understand each other, but the children may not understand the obsession too much. Tony, do we have any more questions for Maria Ivanka? We have time for a couple more.
Okay, we have two more questions. We have a question from Jinja. Maria, is it possible Judit Polgár could be world champion in 2 to 3 years?
Well, they're obsessed with Judith, Maria. We all want her to be world champion, but I think you sort of answered that. But
yeah, it was a quite similar question before. I think if she can win the world championship, it definitely will be in 2, 3, or 5 years. But as I mentioned, it depends on the how the rules are changing and how the United World Championship situation will be solved, which we don't know yet.
It's interesting. I got a question I didn't bother to read you, again, from Chess Guru. He was wondering how she would fare in a challenge match against Kasparov or Kramnik, and I think you've answered that. I think you said if it was 24 games, probably not so well, but if it was 10 or 12 games, you thought anything might happen.
Yes.
And that would be an interesting money-making publicity thing if some wealthy person listening out there or some corporation just put up, you know, $500,000 and said, Mr. Kramnik, Judith is challenging you, winner take all, 10-game match, classical time controls. Be very interesting, Maria. You wouldn't rule her out as having a chance in that situation.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out. I just say that the chances would be better in a shorter match.
Okay.
You can never rule out that the someone who is the underdog, I think that's what you say.
Yes,
would win a match. If we would say that, then the whole idea of any sport game would be unreasonable. Why do you play any game when you already know who is better than who is weaker?
No, absolutely.
The most important thing is when someone who is considered to be weaker will win against the stronger one.
Well, it happened tonight in New York, Maria. The Red Sox beat the Yankees 9-6.
Yeah.
The underdog is bringing it to a game tomorrow, folks. And I actually don't care who wins. I guess I'm rooting a little bit for Red Sox. Sorry, Tony, but I'm a Met fan. I'm a Met fan. And I don't know what the Cubs are doing, but I know that 2 hours ago they were behind 3-0 in the first inning, and so...
Behind 7-5.
How many innings left?
I think one.
Oh, boy. Looks like the Florida Marlins go to the World Series.
Don't jump the gun.
All right.
Oh, we have one more.
Yeah, you're right. If we know the outcome of a sports contest, why would we bother to watch?
Yeah, definitely.
Fred, we have one more question.
Yeah.
A number of our listeners have asked the same question. Maria, can you tell us where we can buy your book online?
Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon.com. Probably that's the easiest way.
And it's called The Silver Queen, right?
Yes.
And what's the retail price, Maria?
The cover price is $21.95, and on Amazon you can buy it cheaper, but I'm not 100% sure. It is approximately $15.
And how many pages? And how many games are in it?
There are information on that, but it is like 300 and some pages.
Uh-huh.
And it has pictures in it. It's a color book with hardcover. So it's a very nice-looking book, and it is good for not only for chess players, even though it has about 100 games in it, but it has a lot of stories and a lot of text, like a novel. So it is quite readable even for like parents of young chess players, for example, who are not really good players themselves, but they can have an idea what is to live in the world of chess.
Yeah, that sounds like it might even be a good book for spouses of addicted chess players to read, so they get an idea of what it's like in the world of professional and Olympic chess. Maria, one last question. Do you still play at all anymore?
I don't play on tournaments anymore, but I do play for fun. So I play blitz games, and I play on simultaneous exhibitions, and of course I am watching all the games most of them on the internet. But if I am back in Budapest or, for example, in Las Vegas on some chess tournaments, then I am watching it.
Well, we should try and get you back to playing again, though, someday. I mean, do you ever feel like it?
I always have had that thought somewhere in my mind, but the problem is that I need at least 1 year of preparation, I think, to get back, because I did not play for quite a long time, about 10 years.
Okay, so it's not out of the question that you'll get the bug again and you'll try and come back and play again, just to play some beautiful games.
Yeah.
Not so much to win money, but to create some nice chess.
Yeah, I think if I return, then I will return just to play, because I love to play chess, I would not return to play for like a world championship or something like that. So.
Well, you had your chances. You took a run at it.
Yeah.
As you say, you're the silver queen. Four silver medals, coming in just behind the Soviets four times in the Olympics. And I think that's an amazing accomplishment. You know, so that you and your friend Verocci were two of the strongest women players in the world for over 10 or 15 years, I suppose.
Yes.
So that is a great accomplishment. Maria, thank you very much for being on my show. And I think, again, remind people that it's, give us your website one more time. It's the address.
IvankaMaria.tripod.com/.
Okay. That's IvankaMaria.tripod.com/. Very, very interesting and very, very nicely produced website. Again, Maria, thanks a lot for appearing on the show. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you do make a comeback sometime.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, what do Hans Rey, Mark Dvoretsky, Gary Lane, and Bruce Pandolfini all have in common? Well, they each write an original monthly column at chesscafe.com. The best in chess, all the time, www.chesscafe.com.
You're on.
Hi, folks. Fred Wilson back. Just to remind you that there's a replay of tonight's show with Maria Ivanka at about 11:05. Also, live coverage continues of the Essent tournament with Judith Polgar, Tony Rook, tomorrow at 8 in the morning. Finally, a reminder that my next week's guest is Gregory Kaidanov, the Pride of Kentucky, a tremendously strong grandmaster who's also a great teacher. Next week, Gregory Kaidanov, Wednesday at 9 p.m. Finally, one thing I forgot to say was the special of the week. You go to FredWilsonChess.com and you read a description of Learn Chess Endgames from the Greats, a lecture I did based on material from Pete Tamburo's book. Today, this week, the week of October 15th through October 22nd, this week only, $15, Learn Chess Endgames from the Greats. A video runs 90 minutes and it will be postpaid to the continental United States. Gregory Kaidanov next week, and remember, folks, always check, it might be made.
No material in any of the broadcasts or webcasts aired here may be copied or rebroadcast without the expressed written consent of Chess FM Media Group, LLC. Any copy, reproduction, display, performance, or retransmission.